Listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you at our new time every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On Connect the Dots, we draw all the connections between what it takes to take care of our health, of ourselves, our families, our communities, our society, and the earth. Connecting the dots between personal health choices that we make and the choices we make as communities, as businesses, as citizens and as a society, because all of those choices impact health either positively, neutrally, or negatively in many cases, sadly. And that's what I cover on this show, and that takes us into a wide range of different areas, and we've had some extraordinary guests. And as we're in the new time slot with more people listening, I want to invite new listeners to check out the Connect the Dots archives on Progressive Radio Network, because we've had an extraordinary array of terrific people. You know, very often I'll begin the show, which I will not be doing today, with specific actions that people can do so that you can become informed, meet the people who are really leading change and creating new understandings, and at the same time very readily have opportunities to become more active as citizens. And that's a featured thing on the show. I am a Huffington Post green and health journalist. I've been doing that 5 years on top of a career of over 20 years of reporting on green and health in real depth, and writing best-selling books and all the rest of it. You can find my blogs on the Huffington Post as well as on my website, healthjournalist.com. I'm really thrilled with having today's guest for our show, actually Jill Stein, who is most likely going to be the Green Party's candidate for President of the United States in the 2012 election, is somebody that I have heard about from so many people in so many directions. And I'm just delighted to have her on the show for our listeners to kind of get to know her, get to know what she offers and what the Green Party offers in this time. You know, we get so hypnotized by the circus, you know, of governmental politics, which is, you know, more distorted than I've ever seen it in my lifetime, and, you know, filled with weirder things. And I've been involved in government and democracy for most of my life, having grown up in a family that was in government. It's really great to meet a sane voice for a better way. And so I'm delighted to welcome to Connect the Dots, Jill Stein. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Allison. It's really it's an honor and a pleasure to be with you. And I think you are so on the money in connecting the dots and making these linkages in a way that really informs and empowers people to be, you know, healthier, happier, more secure citizens of the planet, understanding how we are all in this together and how we can improve it all together. So that, it's great.
That's exactly it. And, you know, you have been taking the lead, you know, politically to kind of really show what broader options can look like. And actually, in looking into your work, I was delighted to discover that actually we've kind of almost come to this work, each the different work that we do, you in politics, me as a communications professional, from the perspective of health. You are a physician, actually.
That's right. And as I was reading over your history, I was very struck by what similar trajectories we're on. And I think in a way, our experience reflects that of our generation and our moment in history where we have enormous potential to see what's going on and then to do something about it. And for me, it was working as a health professional, as a medical doctor, and seeing what was going wrong, both the healthcare system as well as the kinds of epidemics of disease that were descending upon us. And so I became active after 10 or 15 years as a clinical doctor. I became upset and wanted to do something about it and began working with community groups initially and then eventually with Physicians for Social Responsibility and other advocacy groups to try to fix the healthcare system and to try to fix the drivers in our communities that create the conditions for health and disease in a way that makes it eminently fixable and just, you know, inexcusable not to be doing something about when the current, shall we say, era of sickness and a sick care system rather than a health care system is just costing us enormously in terms of our lives, the quality of lives, our health, the struggles with chronic disease and our pocketbooks, because as consumers and as a municipal society and as a nation, we are, you know, we're going bankrupt under this kind of healthcare system instead of going upstream and fixing those initial causes, which is really the place that you have to act.
Well, we're soulmates. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it is incredible how obvious this is to those of us who've taken a deep dish look at this and aren't just kind of set about to participate and profit from this state of affairs, and yet how overlooked it is by so many people. I've been in the world of communicating about health through the media, and you know, we do, and I have written best-selling prescriptive health books, and practiced all kinds of health techniques and everything, even here on Progressive Radio. They have this show listed as the lifestyle show, ironically, because, you know, so many people want like healthy lifestyle advice, and I wouldn't knock it. And we all can use it and we all can benefit from it. And I've done it myself throughout my entire adult life. And I think I'm in pretty solid shape because of it. So I would be the last to sort of put a thumbs down on that. And yet that alone will never be enough unless we address the causes. And what are the causes? I mean, I'd love to hear your perspective on the causes.
Great. And if I can just add one thing to that beautiful framework that you just laid out about how we need to go upstream to the causes, what became really clear to me as a health professional trying to advocate that even when we have terrific, win-win, cost-effective, life-saving solutions, they don't get implemented because we're part of a decision-making system, a system of governance that gives power to basically the foxes guarding the chicken coop, or shall we say the foxes devouring the chickens inside the chicken coop, so that part of healing the system is also healing our democracy and essentially reviving that democracy, which has been sold to the highest bidder, so that even when the public is behind these solutions, which will save us money, save our health, and save the planet, and they all go hand in hand because we cannot save our health without also saving the planet. Mm-hmm. We get a twofer in this. By doing the right things, it's not just good for health and the economy, you know, and the planet and the climate and all that. They go together. What's not to love about this? Well, what's not to love about it is that the guys making the decisions are being paid essentially by those who profit from the status quo. So it will never be changeable until we also fix the status quo. And it took me about 10 or 15 years of activism to catch on to what was going on here, that we were only moving backwards, not forwards, that if we wanted to move to a system of recycling our trash instead of burning it into our air and into our water, dumping it into our water and our land and so on, as simple a thing as that, where we could be creating so many jobs by just moving to a recycling and reuse kind of system and saving ourselves all kinds of health and environmental catastrophes, you can't go there because the guys who make the decisions are paid to be there. Their campaigns are sponsored by not only the incinerator industry and the chemical industry and, you know, in the fossil fuel industry, and it goes out from there. So it became really clear to me. It was such an awakening when I realized that we actually had to reform our democracy as part of getting to a healthier, just, and sustainable world.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it amazing? I mean, to me, that is just it's rational, it's clear. I mean, so much of what we're hearing in the political battlefield today is not rational and very confused. It's very confused thinking. So all this energy is spent unraveling and countering confused, irrational thought. And what you've just said is so clear, rational, and makes good sense. So, but why is it that people, for example, because, you know, this progressive radio is a bit of a health-oriented network founded by Gary Null. I come from that background, and a lot of our listeners are interested in that. Why is it that we could ever think I can be healthy? I'm going to put on like a body armor that's called organic food and healthy exercise and meditation so that I will be immune from everything else going on in our society. And I alone will be healthy even if we lose our democracy, even if we poison our water supply, I will be healthy. You know, how is it that people – I mean, I realize that people, you know, want to kind of take cover and sort of protect themselves, you know, with anything they can find with all that's raining down nowadays on us in terms of our health, environment, mm-hmm. and politics and economy. Mm-hmm. But why do people subscribe to that kind of myth, in your opinion?
In my experience, people are generally there because they don't know that there's an option, you know, and this doesn't happen by accident. There's enormous effort put in to the media and our communications and our political parties to systematically suppress the knowledge of alternatives. And I would include, you know, not only the alternatives about good food and healthy, you know, healthy eating and avoiding chemical exposures and all that, but just knowing that there is a way to fix the democracy problem, that there are political solutions out there. The environment is extremely politically repressive, and it's money that buys politics and non, you know, you have to look to find the channels of non-corporate political solutions. But this is the wonderful thing about the moment that we're in right now. People are clamoring for a different kind of politics. Recent polls suggest that like 49% of people are saying we need a third party that will offer something different. And nearly as many people are saying they will seriously consider voting for it.
That's an enormous number.
It is.
So what is the Green Party that third party? I mean, you know, is that the third party? Is that the option that we have? Tell us more, tell our listeners more about that.
Yes. I mean, in my view, you know, we need a multi-partisan democracy. That's what makes for democracy, is having many voices. The Green Party is sort of the one non-corporate voice that has mm-hmm. managed to survive. There have been many efforts over the last couple of decades, the New Party, the Socialist Party, the Peace and Freedom Party, Labor Party, you name it, there are many efforts to establish non-corporate politics, but the environment out there is such a wipeout, and there is such fear-mongering about actually standing up and asserting your values politically, that you know, people don't know that there are options, or they are afraid. The Green Party is the one party that has managed to maintain a national presence, so that we are on the ballot now in about half of states, but within the next couple months we will be on the ballot to be able to offer a choice to voters effectively all over the country. There will be one or two states where the rules of ballot access are so prohibitive that we can't get on unless you've got millions to spare in the effort. So we can't do every state, but we will be on in the states encompassing about 98% of voters in the country. So we will be there. Most people don't know about us, and I would just encourage people to go to my website just to find out that there is – you will have a choice. You will have someone on the ballot that reflects what you think about what our jobs ought to be about, what our communities ought to be about the health and sustainability that can be and should be just built into our lives. These are not rocket science solutions. These are very practical, everyday, tried and true kinds of solutions that are cost effective and life saving to implement. You will have a choice to not just be out there voting with your feet, but out there voting with your vote. And the point that I try to make to tell people is that, you know, we're going to try to win this election. It's obviously a very steep uphill battle, but there are more ways than one to win it. If you silence yourself, you've basically eliminated your agenda from consideration. But by being in that mix, by standing up and actually pushing forward the kinds of solutions that we need, you push them, you drive them into the political agenda, and we can move those solutions forward and win simply by getting closer or implementing, you know, a safer chemicals policy, a precautionary principle kind of regulation, you know, a healthcare system that provides for real health care and not just sick care. All kinds of solutions like that that the public really supports, we can rally around in the course of a presidential election and make this a win, whether we are 2% of the vote or 52% of the vote. And you start somewhere, you drive your solutions forward, and you build from there.
Well, you know, all of the things that you're mentioning, you know, I've reported on the Safer Chemical policy and the attempts to pass the Safer Chemicals Act. I've reported on energy policy and the need to come up with solutions which are evolving so that we're not relying on fossil fuels or nuclear, all of that. But I'm going to ask you, so, you know, my heart is with you, but I'm going to ask you what I know will be an inevitable question in listeners' minds after certain of our prior presidential elections, which is, you know, I mean, I think I reside in New York State. So in New York State, I think it's a pretty safe bet that I could safely vote for the Green Party. Personally, I could do that because we're not at risk here that the state will go for, you know, somebody who maybe is mentally unstable, you know, which is a way a lot of certain candidates out there look from my perspective as someone who's been in healthcare for many years. But, you know, there may be states where people are afraid that if they that even if they don't like what the incumbent, you know, is doing in all areas and wish that, you know, the president, for example, you know, waffled on the XL pipeline. First it was yes, then it was no, now it's been defeated. You know, we hope they don't come back again. You know, he hasn't been as strong a voice, for example, for the real energy independence that we need from fossil fuels, for example. He did stand up for healthcare reform. It didn't go as far toward prevention, precaution, proactivity as some of us would have liked to have seen, you know, but is a vote for the Green Party putting, you know, potentially a spoiler vote that you know, puts mentally unstable people, for example, into power?
I think, you know, you raise a really important point, and I think it's really important to put it up front and to address it. And I think it's important to look at where we are, because 10 years ago we were told, you've got to be afraid. You know, you've got to vote your fears and not your values. It's important to look at where that got us. Look at where we are. And what we've seen is that silence, political silence, is not an effective strategy. That the politics of fear has basically delivered everything we were afraid of. That is the expanding wars, massively expanding wars, the massive Wall Street bailouts, the skyrocketing gap between rich and poor, the privatization of education, the high rates of unemployment, high and chronic and not getting better, the, you know, more and more free trade agreements, which basically undermine the ability of workers to negotiate security and decent salaries. And on climate, I mean, look at what Obama actually did. You know, he's been cheerleading now the beginnings of the Keystone Pipeline, you know, and he's celebrating that that its construction has begun. He has opened up our national lands and our offshore oil. He's basically adopted drill, baby, drill. He personally undermined the international accords in Durban, South Africa, and basically wrote us into climate catastrophe, saying that we will not have a national accord on this until 2020 or later. And that is too late if you look at the science. So you know, to look at what we've achieved with the politics of fear, it got us everything we were afraid of. Because unless you have the voice of the public interest in the mix, you basically have a free fall to the right. Mm-hmm. All you have, if you don't have public interest voices, are corporate voices. Mm-hmm. So, yes, you can find differences between them, but not enough difference to save our lives or to save our planet. And the clock is ticking. It's really important that we reject the politics of fear and we answer it with the politics of courage. To quote Frederick Douglass, you know, the famous emancipated slave, a power never concedes without a demand. It never has and it never will. Mm-hmm. And what independent third parties do is formulate that demand and bring it into that big public dialogue that we call electoral politics and presidential elections. And if you have silenced your demand from that setting, then forget it. It basically doesn't exist if it is not a part of that dialogue. So if our voices aren't there, we don't move forward. But look what happens if our voices are there. The history of progress, of social and environmental and economic progress, is basically paved by the collaboration of social movements and small third parties, small independent parties, starting with, for example, the Liberty Party and the abolition of slavery. So the Liberty Party took up that cause and helped to drive it into the Republican Party, one of the bigger parties. But it's got to start there with a small independent political group that's not controlled by the establishment and by big money. It happened on the abolition of slavery. It happened for women's suffrage and women achieving the vote through the Women's Party. Same thing for the rights of labor unions to organize and to have a 40-hour week and child labor laws through the Socialist Party and the Labor Party, and on up, you know, including through the Green Party and its ability to drive environmental policies forward, particularly in Germany, where it really got well established. And there you see Germany, you know, the first to phase out nuclear power, to just totally shut it down, and to be making huge strides forward with the green economy. So it's not just that it's okay to vote your values. It's essential to vote your values. There is a fear campaign out there, and it's important to look at who sponsors that fear campaign. That fear campaign is, you know, sponsored by the same deep pockets that are sponsoring the big corporate political parties. They need us to be quiet because the public agrees with us, and it's very dangerous if we start, very dangerous to them, if we start to take back that promise of our democracy, because with it comes the whole agenda for a peaceful, just, secure green future that actually is within our reach. But it needs to be formulated and inserted into the broader political dialogue.
You know, that's really interesting, and I want to talk more about what the new Green Deal, new green economy looks like. Maybe we'll, you know, kind of delve into that in the second half of the show, because I think it's really important. But just taking up your current point about the fear, I've basically wondered about that, and I'm not an expert on this at all. But it seems like, you know, there's a small group of people that may be, you know, interested in supporting some of these irrational candidates, but not really, but it's not really the average American, I don't believe, and I don't think it's really most people. So I've just been remarking that, you know, we spend an enormous amount of time and an enormous amount of money and media attention, and of course I always think of that coming from the media, you know, harping over the last idiotic word of, you know, I'm not using anyone's names here, but, you know, a lot of irrational fringe kind of people, unfortunately, who are no longer in a fringe position. Yet I think that unless we no longer have free elections, you know, due to manipulation at the polls, which is not, you know, or the barring from voting of voters, as we've seen, you know, with some of the ALEC initiatives. Unless we have that, it seems to me that, you know, too much energy is really devoted to that, and it's a distraction. And what is it a distraction from? It's a distraction from really addressing the true issues that we face.
Exactly.
And who is interested in mounting being a distraction. So this has been a question that I've just sort of privately had in my mind. This is not my area of expertise specifically, but what you're implying in what you say, Jill, is that it's actually if people, when you say it's a fear campaign, that's a fear campaign, you know, putting up a lot of candidates who attack women, who are irrational, who say that God wants hydraulic fracturing, other kinds of really off-the-wall statements. I mean, who is the target of that? The person who's becoming afraid is actually the likely Obama or Democratic candidate voter. Those are the people like me. Those would be the people becoming afraid. The people who want that are not becoming afraid as a result of hearing these guys, no matter how slim a minority they may be. So what you're actually saying is that or you're implying that there could actually – this could be part of the overall picture so that people stay on board with a more mainstream candidate rather than, you know, using an opportunity for pushback and allying around candidates that meet their needs better.
Yes, and it's hard to know what goes on,
right?
You know, in the halls of power, and there clearly are halls of power, and there are people with enormous, you know, inconceivable amounts of money and resources who are talking to each other. And ALEC is one expression of that that we've sort of learned about after decades of its existence. So there are ways that power firewalls itself. And who knows what those are. But what's become really clear to me is that they would like us to spend all of our time thinking about, you know, the horse race, who's ahead, who's not, how to strategically, you know, target our votes and all that. They'd like us to think about everything but what we need, the jobs we need, the health care, the schools, getting out of debt, you know, mortgages we can afford, the things that people are really strapped about. They don't want us talking about, and they don't want us promoting solutions for, because that would really mobilize people. And I think it's important to look at what's happening now and what has happened over the past year in the Middle East, where there was no media support for what happened, for these democracy revolutions. There was no, you know, official political support for it either. This was about ordinary people communicating with each other largely through the internet and through Facebook and standing up for what needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, that has a lot to teach us about finding our spine and standing up for our vision and moving forward. Because if we simply focus on the vision, there are more than enough of us to command the majority. Most people, remember, are not voting. It's, you know, it's about half of people that generally are not voting because they've already, you know, decided that what's being offered by corporate politics is not for them. So to my mind, the real strategy we need to be thinking about is not how to work with this very corrupt and, you know, gone mad political system. Mm-hmm. It's about how we take it back. It belongs to us. And mm-hmm. better, I think, to spend our time thinking about how to reach out to people who are with us around health, around climate, around jobs, around homes, around affordable schools. This is where we actually recover, I think, the momentum we need to take our democracy back. Mm-hmm. When our campaign launched, when we launched, we went to a Midwestern public university, the Western Illinois University, where North meets South and urban meets rural, a very conservative university that's, well, I should say generally middle of the pack, definitely not progressive or third party. And they were holding a mock election, and I was invited to come by a young woman who called me up and introduced herself to me as my campaign manager at the campus and said, you know, we're going to have a full election here, complete with an electoral college and conventions and all that, and you've got to come out on election night because it's really important for people to hear what you're about. So I thought about it, and I said, well, hell yes. What is our campaign about, you know, but the future and the young people who are taking us there? So we went there to basically launch our campaign trail, And I had 6 minutes to make the case on election night. And we were running effectively about 3% in their polls, looking at who signed up for which conventions and so on. Green Party was about 3%. And I had 6 minutes to make the case for why students should vote green. And to make a long story short, at the end of the evening, we went from 3% to 27%, which, as you know, in a three-way race is pretty darn close to a tie or to winning it based on 3 minutes in a 6 minutes at a school that had never voted green or independent or progressive. And to me, it was such a flabbergasting demonstration of how the public, and young people in particular, really have a very different sense of what, you know, how to fix this, and also a very different sense of the crisis. They are not worried about spoiling some politician's career. They're really worried about the spoiled chances they have for getting a job and the spoiled debt history they're emerging from college with, where 30 million students now, you know, are basically up to their eyeballs in student loans without having prospects of jobs to be able to pay those loans back. And they're looking at the spoiled climate that they are, you know, running headlong into right now. So they're pretty motivated to really dig in and change this. They are not thinking about some political calculations that that the system would like to drive into us and make us very worried about what happens if I do this and what happens if I do that and do I dare to eat a peach, so I better just give a mandate for 4 more years of corporate rule. And that is what you're doing if you just sign on to more of the same. Whether you're in a safe state or a not safe state, none of us are in a safe state. We're in a very dangerous world, and if we don't use our votes to get out of it, we're all, you know, sitting on the sidelines at a time when that is lethal.
We've got a break coming up here. This is Allison Rose Levy on Connect the Dots. I'm speaking with Green Party presidential candidate, likely, Bill Stein. Stay with us for the second half coming up after the station identification. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. This is the second half of our show. We're with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy from the Huffington Post and healthjournalist.com, speaking today with Jill Stein, the likely a presidential candidate for the 2012 election from the Green Party. We've been discussing why a green vote is a critical vote at this time in terms of really turning things in our government and in our society and in our world in a healthier, more environmentally sane, economically sound, and humane direction. And Jill Stein has just been kind of cluing us in about all of that. She's a physician and has been involved in politics and really got involved with a healing impulse and has been following through on that in a time when so many things have become imbalanced and gone awry in our society and in our world. So coming back to our conversation, Jill, and also I just want to mention to listeners, too, you can find her online at jillstein.org, and that's a great place to learn more about her candidacy, get involved, read the complete Green New Deal and what that entails. And, you know, it's I tell you, I think it makes a lot of sense. Everything we're talking about really makes a lot of sense. It's kind of like cleaning the glass on the windshield and having a kind of clearer, direct view of reality, as well as and you know, that's really the first step to taking action and going further to feel that, you know, we can drive the car in a better direction if we can see out the windshield clearly. And so I'm really appreciating that today in the conversation with you very much, Jill. You know, tell us a little, you know, it's really what you were describing in the last segment is really poignant, you know, and it's really kind of hammering in my mind, because there was a piece on Huffington on the Impact page in this last week that in a study of young people had shown that the millennials, the people now in college, now graduating, are less concerned about the environment than maybe the image of young people being deeply concerned that we have. Now, it could have just been a debunking study, because as one who's, you know, looked at a lot of studies, and studies come from all places, they're done in all kinds of ways and by all kinds of people, so I haven't really drilled into who was doing this study and how they framed it and what they found. But it does make sense. And, you know, and I know that I kind of, in going out and about in my world of media coverage and advocacy, you know, I encounter people, some young people really awakened to the call, really concerned, motivated, and active. And then there are many others who are just trying to kind of find a niche in the storm, which is becoming harder and harder to do. You mentioned in the last segment, you know, about the difficulty of finding jobs, leaving school with large bills and no way to pay them. And therefore, it also, I think, drives some young people toward, you know, any job I could take or anything I could do just to survive in this world. So there's kind of a just, you know, a bifurcation. And the same thing, of course, holds true for adults, you know, just like, where is, can I just find shelter in the storm here, versus let's get into, you know, this big bus where you've just cleaned the windshield and drive together toward real goals that we want to reach. You want to comment on that? And maybe we can go from there to talking about, you know, what the Green New Deal would look like.
Sure. And, you know, I think there's no doubt, well, from my experience out there on the street and talking to young people, and I spend a lot of time on college campuses, there's no doubt that people are very anguished, and we're seeing this not only in the public colleges and universities, you know, which are not privileged students, but we're also seeing it in the private colleges and universities, where people are really concerned, even though they're not as impacted on their own pocketbook. But it's clearly a cross-section of issues. There's no doubt that we are hitting a breaking point, you know, that the planet is at a breaking point. Just to look at climate alone, we're clearly in trouble. But, you know, we're hitting that breaking point in so many ways. The gap between rich and poor has become absolutely untenable. The economy is really in a standstill. You know, our housing system is, you know, we're driving millions of families out of their homes every year. Increasingly, people can't afford their health care, and they have policies which are lousy. Even that, you know, national Obamacare doesn't begin to do the job, except for a little bit around the margins. You know, it's really not health care reform, and it guarantees that we're going to go bankrupt trying to pay for it. So, you know, we're not getting solutions. There is no doubt increasing frustration and desperation out there as to, you know, what kinds of solutions people key into. I think the important thing is that people are very open and that they are really demanding change. To look at, for example, the uprisings in Wisconsin, which were really led by young people, or the Occupy movement, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement all over this country is very much led by young people. So to look at what's, and the democracy revolutions, for that matter, in the Middle East, are very much driven by young people in exactly the same conditions that prevail here. That is, people who've been somewhat educated, they don't have job opportunities, they are young. And I think this confluence of a system unraveling, an economy and an ecology, which are both unraveling at the same time, that coincides with the coming of age politically of an entire generation, which is on the receiving end of this system, an exploitive political system and an exploitive economy, for whom young people have just been another, you know, another cash cow to try to wring money out of. You know, students don't have a lobbyist, so they're getting the short end of the stick on loans and jobs and all, and on education, to say the least, on tax policy, you name it. They're getting really the short end of the stick at the very time that they are coming of age politically, and it is a very potent combination. And this is what makes for change at exactly the time we need it. So, you know, I say thank you to the universe for making this opportunity line up with this time of, I think, unprecedented crisis that really demands that we transform a breaking point into a tipping point. And mm-hmm. that's what's happening. And that's what our campaign gives a voice to. It brings that uprising for democracy and justice into the electoral arena so that we can be empowered as voters to do what democracy is supposed to do.
That's a big thing because a lot of people are really disaffected. You know, that's a huge thing. I remember during the 2008 election mm-hmm. In which, you know, President Obama was first elected, and I was talking to my niece, you know, college student and all, and she basically showed me some websites that she and her friends were listening to and following, and you know, basically it made everyone look like a joke. So mm-hmm. it was basically like, adults can't be trusted. This is, they're all impossible. We don't want anything to do with this. Goodbye. You know, which I could mm-hmm. certainly understand why they would feel that sense of write-off. And I feel a sense of responsibility about the fact that, you know, that we've created, allowed to be created a world situation mm-hmm. Where they're feeling that way, but at the same time, you know, the notion that the ultimate solution is just, well, we throw our hands up into the air and write it off, that's not good news for anybody at all. Now, what is you know, one of the things that I have reported on extensively in this show, and I know it will be coming up at the Forum in New York, which you're here to attend over the weekend. Our show will be broadcast afterward, or I would be kind of promoting that. But, you know, one of the things that we've reported, that I've reported on extensively, is the threat represented by hydraulic fracturing or mm-hmm. fracking to mm-hmm. the water supply, the air supply, the water infrastructures that bring water down to New York City from upstate New York, as well as occurring, if it does come to the state, in agricultural regions, mm-hmm. Where our food, the famous New York food of the famous New York foodies and restaurants, mm-hmm. You know, the healthy, sustainable food comes from these regions. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, for mysterious reasons, and they're not so mysterious, our Democratic Governor Cuomo, you know, who has presidential aspirations, is, you know, has basically said, you know, we're going to proceed with this, and even without a health assessment of any kind or socioeconomic assessment of what the real impact would be. It's an unstudied process that's been exempted from environmental regulations. You know, so, you know, there isn't a party between the two main parties. There's no party immune from, you know, kind of making deals in order to assure election mm-hmm. results and all. But you're not functioning. Your whole, the Green Party doesn't function from corporate giveaways.
Exactly. Which, you know, I think it underscores the very important point here that in order to fix the problems, we've got to simultaneously fix the system. And that's why, you know, I think that's why voting with your vote as well as with your feet about fracking is really, excuse me, is really important to do, because the corporate-sponsored political parties are not going to solve this for us. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to just say goodbye to that system, kiss it goodbye. They have not fundamentally been solving problems for us for quite some time. Mm-hmm. The Democrats have been selling themselves as just half of a disaster instead of the full disaster that the Republicans would bring. And one of the images that I sometimes use to capture this is, you know, to think about those two corporate political parties as ships going down. Both of them are going down. One may be going down faster than the other, but they're both going down. And when you're on a sinking ship, your objective is not to get onto another ship that's also headed for the bottom of the ocean, just not quite as quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't fix it. We need to get onto the really solid and stable, sustainable, large lifeboat of the Green Party and build it, because this is where we start to fix the fracking problem. you know, the whole concept that we would be moving forward with fracking at a time when our water supplies are all the more, you know, precious and vital, absolutely critical, with the threats of climate change coming upon us, as well as, you know, issues of fuel availability and cost and all that, we badly need to have water supplies to drink from and also to nourish local sustainable agriculture. This is really critical. So on those grounds alone, we should not be moving towards fracking. And then to look at the planet, you know, we should not be opening up in the climate. We should not be opening up new sources of greenhouse gases now. We should only be moving towards renewable and sustainable clean energy. We should be in the business of closing down all fossil fuels, not opening up new reservoirs.
Yes, and studies have shown that, in fact, because of methane release, that fracking is worse than mountaintop removal, which is really, you know, a shocker because it's sort of almost counterintuitive, unless you've been near one of these sites. But it's true. I mean, given that, that the Green Party is the Green Party, do you have sort of tangible ways to develop, a new green economy with green energy, that really could work and create a transition? This is always a big question for people, creating a transition in a time frame where, you know, suddenly people aren't like, I can't drive my car kind of thing.
yeah, exactly. And we are in a twin crisis right now between the climate and unemployment. So it's perfectly positioned for an emergency solution to both of those crises. And that's what our program, the Green New Deal, is all about. It is an emergency program to put 25 million people back to work at the same time that we end unemployment, put a stop to the recession, jumpstart the green economy, and combat climate change all in one. And I'd add to that, what this also does, by the way, is drastically improve our health, because a number of conditions go with this and the jobs that would be created that are extreme, that basically lay the groundwork for healthy communities by way of healthy food, an active transportation system, clean air, and the absence of chemicals derived from fossil fuels in our air, water, et cetera. So there are enormous health benefits and savings that accrue at the same time. And I would just mention briefly what happened in Cuba when their oil pipeline went down and they had to adopt an organic, local, plant-based food system overnight, as well as an active transportation system. They had to start biking and walking, and they weren't breathing the air pollution from the use of fossil fuels, because they just, nada, you know, it just wasn't available when the old Soviet Union collapsed. And what happened almost overnight, within 2 to 3 years, you could measure vast drops in their rates of death from diabetes and heart disease and stroke. Obesity and its complications all went down. So, I mean, you had this health revolution, which cost $0, zero. And their health improved. You know, these were improvements in mortality of 20% to 35%, almost overnight.
That's amazing.
It is amazing, because with a $1 trillion healthcare system, we can't even come close to that. So, I mean, the point is that we can afford this. We can afford
to do this.
Plus, it makes wars for oil obsolete when we have a green energy economy. So there's no question that we can afford this. This is purely a political question. And the jobs that it would create, you know, are the jobs in the areas of the green economy, and also the jobs that provide for our social and economic needs, because we talk about making communities sustainable, not just ecologically, but socially and economically as well. The program would put communities in charge so that it's nationally funded, but it's locally controlled, so that communities have the ability to define what kinds of jobs that they need. And there would be a whole spectrum of them created both in the private sector and in the public sector, including public works and public services, like in the New Deal of the 1930s. 1930s that helped us out of the Great Depression. It would also help jumpstart small businesses and the point, as well as worker cooperatives and community cooperatives. So it's a whole mix. The communities get to decide what they need, including teachers and nurses and drug rehabilitation and et cetera. So it's a mix of jobs and a mix of kinds of jobs to help jumpstart the green economy that, you know, is really what our future depends on. And it's a win-win all around.
It sounds terrific. I mean, it's the green economy. It's the healthy economy.
Exactly.
It's the health saving, life saving.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and it's like I'm signed on because I'm ready to get in there and write pamphlets and speeches and blogs and everything.
I love it. Okay.
Because you know, honestly, because you know, the thing that gets left out, you know, when people say green, there are some people who get green, you know, and then there are a lot of people who are like, I don't care about the mountain hawk, you know, but they do care about their health.
Exactly.
If they've gotten sick, they do care about, you know, their home, and they do care about their job and their kids' jobs and all of that. And so this really addresses this on multiple fronts. You know, we've got a few minutes left to the show. So, you know, before we close and we'll go out on a final thought, but I just want to urge listeners to go to jillstein.org where you can learn more about this and sign up to participate. I love the whole health orientation. You can also sign up for my weekly e-zine, The Health Outlook, at healthjournalist.com or healthjournalistblog.com, my websites, and follow me as well on the Huffington Post. But, you know, there are a lot of answers here in what you're saying. I mean, you know, we're looking – one of the reasons people feel overwhelmed, and we can kind of – you know, we only have about another 2 minutes here, but I'd love you to have the last word on this one, Jill, and, you know, then we'll kind of close the show up. You know, one of the reasons people feel overwhelmed is that this needs fixing and that needs fixing and this needs fixing. But in the way you articulated, it's actually just a few major social drivers that have taken over to our detriment that really need fixing. And the answer to that is all of us standing up and making that happen.
Exactly.
And, you know, with those, and then through making some of the adjustments you're talking about, a lot of things are fixed simultaneously.
That's
so
right.
It actually isn't that complicated.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, doing it is going to be, take some work, but it's not, but what needs to be shifted is pretty focused in a way. And you're really doing multiple fixes in doing any given one thing.
Exactly. And just by focusing on greening our economy, we green our communities, we make the planet sustainable, we retrieve our health. So in the same way that problems converge and you can think, oh my God, you know, everything is failing us. Well, when you flip it around, the solutions converge too. And, you know, sometimes we say healthy people, healthy planet. When you do what's right for people, you're doing what's right for the planet and vice versa. And the bottom line is that democracy fixes itself. So all we have to do is get our democracy going again, and people are already on it. You know, they're on it. They've got the blueprints ready to go. There's a lot of important, creative, and healing discussion in the process, and it will sort itself out. But what we need is a system, you know, a system of governance that is democracy, that allows us to put our best vision and our best values forward. Democracy needs a moral compass. We don't have that moral compass if we're silencing ourselves. And
this is a place to begin. I'm going to have to end our show here.
Okay, great.
We'll have to have you come back again. Once is not enough with presidential candidate Jill Stein running for the Green Party in 2012.
Great.
You know, tune into what she's about at her website, jillstein.org. And also, stay tuned, come back next week for Connect the Dots. I'm going to be featuring a whole bunch of people coming to the Green Festival, which is coming to New York in a few weeks' time in April. Thank you so much, Jill. It's great having you here.
Great talking with you, Allison. Thanks so much. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.